Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. Over the next 60 minutes, you'll hear some of the top stories and features of the past week from our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington.
Microsoft confirmed that it has held talks with Chinese technology company ByteDance to acquire its popular social app TikTok in the United States. Microsoft said it will work with the U.S. government on a deal that they hope will wrap up by September 15th. Matt Dibble has the story.
TikTok has been attracting attention since it was introduced, and not just from teenagers. For over a year, the popular social media app owned by Chinese tech company ByteDance has been under review by the Trump administration for national security concerns. After first threatening to ban the app in the United States, President Donald Trump softened his position Sunday after a phone call with the CEO of Microsoft, which is in talks to buy the company. TikTok has millions of users in the U.S. and is wildly popular with teens, allowing them to share short, self-recorded, often humorous videos with other users. Like other social media apps, Facebook and WhatsApp, it collects data from its users. As big tech has increasingly come under scrutiny for data harvesting in the U.S., the possibility of TikTok user data finding its way to the Chinese government has raised alarm among some U.S. leaders.
I think the concern is about the long-term political, economic, and intelligence value of this data set that you would collect on young people in the United States. And young people, 10 years from now, become middle-aged people. Middle-aged people, some subset of them, end up in positions of authority or in positions of important intellectual property ownership or that sort of thing.
TikTok's meteoric rise has drawn attention for other reasons, too. Best known for viral comedy and dance videos, young activists have used it successfully to support the Black Lives Matter movement, and in an online prank played on the Trump campaign. Empty seats at the June re-election rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, were partly the result of TikTok users organizing to register for free tickets they had no intention of using. Former employees and leaked documents have revealed that TikTok has censored content unflattering to the Chinese government, such as the Hong Kong democracy protests, as reported by the Washington Post and other media outlets. On Monday, President Trump said that TikTok could stay in business in the U.S. under certain conditions.
I don't mind if, whether it's Microsoft or somebody else, a big company, a secure company, very, very American company, buy it.
The once close relationship between Chinese and American tech companies began to erode when smartphone maker Huawei and meeting platform Zoom also found themselves in the crosshairs of American lawmakers for security reasons.
2 years ago, I think there were lots of folks who were of the opinion that it was absolutely inconceivable that the United States and China would be able to sort of disaggregate their supply chain when it comes to technology. And I think many of those people have been surprised at just how far the United States has been willing to go over the last year to do that.
Trump has set a September 15th deadline for a TikTok purchase deal with an American company. Meanwhile, Facebook's subsidiary, Instagram, is preparing to release in the coming weeks a new app that closely resembles TikTok, all of which means the clock is ticking for TikTok. For VOA News, Matt Dibble, San Francisco.
I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington as VOA Asia Weekend continues. A new book offers an on-the-ground account of the rewards and roadblocks faced by an American scholar as he engaged one of the world's most closed-off states, North Korea. Jason Strother opens the book in Seoul.
Andre Abrahamian spent much of the past decade working with North Koreans who have never lived outside of Pyongyang's tightly controlled political and economic system. In his new book, Being in North Korea, the former executive director of the international nonprofit organization Chosun Exchange reflects on his efforts to teach business skills and market economic policies to those people.
The idea of using markets and individuals making market choices and participating in ways that benefits them, I think that idea has powerfully taken hold now in North Korea.
Abrahamian was among a small group of experts working for international organizations that have built trust with North Korea. These groups provide humanitarian assistance to the North and have helped guide the government to take steps to open its economy. During some of his 31 trips to North Korea, Abrahamian ran workshops on entrepreneurship and international trade. He says many of his North Korean colleagues want to start their own businesses, but hit roadblocks because of the country's restrictive policies.
The times you feel closest with North Koreans is when you are mutually trying to solve problems that the system has put up.
But Abrahamian says working in North Korea's system can be mentally exhausting. He says people cannot be completely open or honest out of fear that what they say might draw the attention of authorities.
What I really learned is how difficult it is to live in a system where you have to really regulate your own thoughts very carefully because, you know, thoughts can be dangerous.
Abrahamian argues that despite the frustrations and limitations of engaging with North Korea, it's still a better option than attempting to use military or economic pressure to force the regime to change.
Engagement doesn't solve all the problems. I think that provides more opportunities for individuals to take control over some aspects of their lives.
He adds that Pyongyang's leaders have the tools to keep their system in place for a long time. Jason Strother for VOA News, Seoul.
Students in Indian-controlled Kashmir have had a difficult year. Authorities closed schools in August 2019 after political disturbances in the once semi-autonomous region. Schools opened in February but promptly closed again because of the coronavirus pandemic. As VOA's Arash Arabasadi tells us, students may have found a solution to their education problem right under the sun.
Math students file into their new classroom through this field in Srinagar, Kashmir. Their teacher, Munir Alam, calls education a matter of public health.
The students of this part of the world, Kashmir, they are suffering from mental trauma. They are traumatized. Literally, they are patients. They are the patients of depression.
Last year, authorities closed schools due to heightened political tensions after India revoked the region's semi-autonomous status. Classrooms were reopened in February only to be closed again because of coronavirus. Alam says students have had only 15 days of school since 2019, and it's time to change that.
The driving force of this is to get them out of that depression. They have a habit of leaving their home every day for classes, for teachers, for schools. We have snatched that directly or indirectly by COVID.
Internet restrictions here limit distance learning because of extremely slow network speeds. Students say that's no way to learn.
We used to have online classes, and due to restricted internet, we could not understand well in it. There was buffering, you know, sort of in these online classes, and understanding during that the slow internet was the most difficult task.
It gave us a ray of hope that we can do better in our future, and it will definitely benefit us.
Security lockdowns and information blackouts are not uncommon in Kashmir. But combined with the coronavirus, it all adds up to more than a million students from almost 14,000 schools that haven't had class in almost a year. Munir students say his open-air classroom provides the education that gives them hope for their future. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Presumptive Democratic Party presidential nominee Joe Biden has delayed announcing his pick for his vice presidential running mate, amid speculation of internal opposition to frontrunner California Senator Kamala Harris. VOA's Brian Patton reports that other possible choices are emerging, who are reportedly seen as more of a team player than Harris, a past rival for the Democratic nomination who clashed with Biden during the primary campaign.
Joe Biden has extended his vice presidential search after reports of growing opposition within the party to top contender California Senator Kamala Harris. While campaigning earlier this year, Biden promised to name a highly qualified woman as his running mate. Since then, there has been increasing calls for him to choose an African American as racial equality protests have intensified across the country.
It will go a long way to motivating Black voters and perhaps those young people that are not so keen on him to come to the polls in November.
As a prominent senator, Harris, the daughter of Indian and Jamaican immigrants and a former presidential candidate herself, seemed the likely choice. But Harris's loyalty and ambition are reportedly being questioned by some key Biden advisors. Harris reportedly has yet to reconcile her clashes with Biden in a past debate, and some close to Biden worry that Harris would put her future presidential aspirations ahead of supporting Biden's agenda. Harris is reportedly meeting this week with the Biden campaign to address those concerns. With Biden leading President Donald Trump in presidential election polls, Democratic strategist Jared Leopold expects Biden to shy away from any controversy in selecting his running mate.
So I think that's what he's likely going to go for, is someone who is going to be a solid pick, someone who's trustworthy, someone who can step in on day one, but also someone who's not going to be a lightning rod for criticism.
Meanwhile, other potential vice presidential candidates are also being vetted. Karen Bass, an African-American congresswoman from California who recently emerged as a top contender, is facing criticism for remarks she made that opponents say praise Cuban leader Fidel Castro and the controversial Church of Scientology. Other African-American contenders include National Security Advisor Susan Rice, who has not run for political office in the past, as well as former Georgia State Legislator Stacey Abrams and Florida Congresswoman Val Demings. Both face questions over lack of experience.
So then you have the problem, or the dilemma of, do you choose someone who has less baggage, who isn't obviously unattractive in some way, but is not known and is not tested and can't prove that they could occupy the Oval Office successfully.
Other women politicians reportedly under consideration are Asian American Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois, a disabled veteran of the Iraq War, Michelle Lujan Grisham, the Latina governor of New Mexico, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, and Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Sources now say Biden could announce his vice presidential pick sometime in the next 2 weeks, just before the start of the Democratic Party convention, where he will be officially nominated as the party's presidential candidate. Brian Padden, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello anytime you're online or on your smartphone. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime.
We're back with more VOA Asia Weekend. Due to a rise in COVID cases, Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti announced that he is considering another strict lockdown just a few weeks after the metropolis began to erase restrictions. One problem is that COVID is rapidly spreading in his state prisons. The issue is so worrying that the state is considering releasing about 8,000 prisoners convicted of minor offenses. VOA's Angelina Bagsarian reports as Anna Rice narrates.
California continues to be one of the coronavirus hotbeds with around 400,000 confirmed cases. The situation is particularly grim inside state prisons. To ease the problem, officials say they're looking at releasing 8,000 prisoners convicted of minor offenses with fewer than 180 days left on to serve. Those over 30 who have health problems will be freed first. About 3,000 California inmates have already tested positive for COVID-19. At least 10 people have died. Critics say inmate transfers prompted the rapid spread of the virus in prisons. Since then, state has replaced its top medical examiner for prisons. Former inmates share their experience in prison during the pandemic.
Scary, dangerous, uncomfortable, unpredictable.
The inmates' relatives and close ones are organizing protests near prison walls.
They're dying in there. They're dying.
Free them all!
Free my baby!
Human rights activists say the situation at the San Quentin prison is no surprise.
San Quentin is a very old, antiquated prison. It has a single ventilation system that recirculates air, so it's not a surprise to any of us. Prisons are not meant to be social distance areas.
Vanessa Nelson Sloan is co-founder and director of an organization that helps inmates.
I think, in my considered opinion, would help the most That is, get every single staff member to wear the masks that they have been provided. Prisoners are required to wear masks. The prisoners can be given a disciplinary violation if they don't. The guards are another situation. That, I think, would be the most important thing we could do in all the prisons right now.
The decision to release prisoners is welcomed at the Life Support Alliance, but many here worry that many ex-inmates will have nowhere to go. And since the state's homeless shelters are packed, that makes them risky places to be as well during the pandemic. For Angelina Bogdasaryan in Los Angeles, California, Anna Rice, VOA News.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, one Washington, D.C. resident is using the pandemic as an opportunity to test himself by running 350 kilometers. But it's not just boredom that has this runner hitting the road. Maxim Moskalkov has the story.
Marathoner Corey Capelloni has an incredible running resume. He has conquered all sorts of marathons, including a six-day race in the Sahara Desert, believed to be one of the toughest ultramarathons in the world. But his latest run, a 350-kilometer race from Washington, D.C. to Scranton, Pennsylvania, may be his most difficult. At the end of this race, he'll see his grandmother, who has been diagnosed with COVID-19.
And she was becoming increasingly depressed and scared, worried that she wouldn't be able to see us, and she had no contact with family. I mean, she had contact on the phone, but no physical contact with her family and friends. And so initially I decided to start sending her little gifts every week. So I would send her photography books, boxes of chocolate, other snacks.
The idea to run from Washington, D.C. to Scranton, Pennsylvania to see Ruth occurred to Capelloni's girlfriend, Susan Kaminer.
It was beautiful just seeing him, you know, call his grandmother every other day, and just the effort he made to keep her spirits up, and I just found that so incredibly moving.
The couple discussed the idea with the nursing home where Ruth was living and turned it into a chance to raise money for the facility. Armed with Google Maps and determination, they decided Susan would accompany her boyfriend in an RV and be responsible for logistics and documenting the race. But just days before they planned to head, the nursing home contacted Capelloni to tell him his grandma was diagnosed with COVID-19.
We rented an RV to complete this mission. We wanted to be as self-contained and socially distant as possible. So it was really important for us to just, you know, be on our own and not come into contact with as many people as possible. So the RV was our home. I got to drive it.
The 350-kilometer distance was broken into seven equal parts, each about 50 kilometers long.
Usually when you do an ultramarathon, you train for the ultramarathon, you have some days off before the ultramarathon, you do the ultramarathon, and then you have days off, you relax. Whereas the hard part about this was it was one ultramarathon after another ultramarathon after another after another after another. So like seven ultramarathons, just your body and mind become really exhausted and sore.
On the seventh day, Capelloni made it to the nursing home. However, he couldn't really see his grandmother. Though she was feeling better, she was in strict quarantine and couldn't have any visitors. They still got to talk through a window.
I love you so much.
And honestly, it was really the least I could do because she has always been there for me. Everything that I've accomplished in my life, I can trace back to her. And also to honor the staff that take care of her, because the staff at Allied are really heroic.
To date, Capelloni has already raised over $25,000, and donations keep coming. The funds will be used to buy smartphones and tablets, so that the elderly that found themselves cut off during the pandemic could easily get in touch with their loved ones. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Washington.
There's an old saying in theater that the show must go on. But when a global pandemic hits and the playbook on large gatherings is rewritten, shows like The Circus cannot go on. As VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports, performers in Brazil are taking a page from drive-in movie theaters to save their circus.
The coronavirus hurt artists at Estoril Circus in Rio de Janeiro when social distancing guidelines pulled performers from the stage and audience members from their seats.
For us, it was like losing a loved one. We lost the circus for 4 months with no hope of having it back until the vaccine was found.
Anderson de Souza Silva works as a clown. He is one of 35 performers left from a circus that employed 78 before the pandemic. That he still has a job is thanks to a change in how circus goers watch the show.
Today, thank God, we have the opportunity with the drive-in model to start the performance again. I'm very happy to be part of this new project.
By keeping the audience in their cars, circus administrator Nivaldo Jr. says the show adopted a proven winner for social distancing.
We remember the time of drive-in cinemas back in the day. All this time with no work, we were thinking of a way to relieve the stress the pandemic brought. And then the idea came, the drive-in circus.
Local councilman William Cesar says the show keeps his family grounded in the era of COVID.
To be in contact with the culture is very nice. It is amazing. My daughter is loving it. Many times she's the one honking. They won't hear if we clap, so we honk instead.
For circus staff, the show is an opportunity, both for work and keeping people connected in a time of hardship.
We do it like the cinemas. Families come to the circus and watch this big show to have some joy in these rough times that we are going through during quarantine.
The Estoril Circus started in Portugal in 1898 and has been in Brazil for 30 years. This is the first time crowds of cars circled the stage instead of people. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Two coronavirus vaccines have entered the final phase of testing. There are now 5 shots in the pipeline. Scientists expect to know by the end of the year if any of them are safe and effective. VOA's Steve Barragona has this update.
Tests got underway at 120 sites worldwide on a vaccine developed by drug firms BioNTech, Pfizer, and China's Fosun Pharma. Another 89 sites in the United States are hosting tests on Moderna's vaccine. They're the last set of clinical trials before approval. Frank Ader leads the study at a Moderna site in New York.
And once we get past this trial, we can move into the general public and actually mass producing and having this given to the population.
Before that happens, though, these trials will gauge how well the vaccines work and how safe they are. Though new techniques helped get these shots ready in record time, officials say all the normal safety checks are in place. The tests that just started are a key part of that, says Vanderbilt University infectious disease doctor William Schaffner.
These are new technology vaccines against a new virus in humans. We need to be very careful about that and look at vaccine safety very carefully. That information comes out of the large, we call them phase 3 trials. Those are the ones that are currently underway.
Yeah, go ahead.
Those phase 3 trials involve tens of thousands of patients to look for less common side effects. Scientists hope for results by the end of the year. Another vaccine in phase 3 comes from Oxford University and drug firm AstraZeneca. Like the Moderna and BioNTech vaccines, the Oxford shot triggered immune responses in early tests. But that's not enough, says Oxford's project lead, Sarah Gilbert.
So we don't know how strong that immune response needs to be. So we can't say just by looking at the immune responses whether this is going to protect people or not. And the only way we're going to find out is by doing the large phase 3 trials.
Even before those trials produce results, the British government has given companies millions of dollars and the U.S. government billions to manufacture the vaccines. That way, some doses will be ready right away if results are positive. Sandy Douglas is with the Oxford team.
Vaccine may be available for people in some high-risk groups in the UK by the end of the year, but it won't be made available to everybody immediately. It's likely to be given to the people who have the most to benefit from it, the most to gain from it, earliest and then gradually introduced for other people.
U.S. health officials are also discussing who will get the limited supply of first doses, likely beginning with healthcare workers. Two Chinese companies have vaccines in phase 3 testing in the United Arab Emirates and Brazil. At least 17 other vaccines are in earlier clinical tests around the world. Experts say more is better, because different vaccines may work best for different groups of people. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia Weekend. With the U.S. presidential election fewer than 100 days away, opinion polls give presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden a double-digit lead over President Trump, whose approval ratings have dropped as U.S. coronavirus deaths continue to rise. However, as VOA's Brian Patton reports, the presidential race could still tighten as it becomes less a referendum on the president and more a choice between him and Biden, whose record and proposals will receive more scrutiny when he officially becomes his party's nominee.
President Trump's approval ratings have dropped during the prolonged coronavirus pandemic in the United States, a deep economic recession, and civil unrest. Presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden, who was President Barack Obama's vice president, is now leading in presidential election polls by double digits. His rise is due in large part to a low-key and disciplined campaign that has relentlessly criticized Trump's handling of the crisis and slammed Trump's erratic messaging, including denying responsibility for how America handles the pandemic.
He's shown that he can't beat the pandemic and keep you safe. He can't turn the economy around and get America back to work.
Despite bleak polling data, Trump's backers say if the U.S. can slow the coronavirus infection rate or develop an effective vaccine before the November election, the president's prospects will improve.
The more the focus remains on the pandemic, the better Biden, the better shape Biden's in. So any issue or combination of issues that move the focus away from the pandemic is probably going to hurt Biden by helping Trump.
The president's supporters also see opportunity as protests for racial justice have been marred by violence, arguing Trump's law and order message will resonate as unrest continues in several American cities. Biden, for his part, has been careful not to endorse protesters' calls to disband or defund police forces. A political moderate, Biden has nonetheless put forward expansive and expensive economic, environmental, and health care plans Republicans will attack as job-killing and socialist, hoping to appeal to pro-business, independent voters. At the same time, the president's strong opposition to abortion, gun control, and illegal immigration is likely to keep enthusiasm high among his base supporters. Biden's choice of a female vice presidential running mate expected in coming days will appeal to core Democratic constituencies, but could also alienate moderates if seen as too progressive and divide the party if not seen as progressive enough. For the 77-year-old Biden, who is known for making verbal gaffes, the upcoming presidential debates present a potential hazard. But supporters say Biden will be prepared for attacks from Trump.
He knows what his focus is. It's the economy, it's healthcare, it's the pandemic. And when he comes into a debate situation, that's exactly what he's going to focus on.
Many 2016 polls incorrectly predicted Trump would lose to then-Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton. Democratic and Republican strategists agree current polls in no way guarantee a Biden victory in November. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. Hundreds of companies in the United States are using a variety of methods to get Americans to vote in November's presidential election. Many are giving their workers paid time off on Election Day, while others are helping people register to vote, offering reduced fares for transportation to polling stations, or helping to feed them once they're there. VOA's Julie Tabo has more from the spokesman of a company with employees worldwide and a political expert, who says these incentives could have a significant impact on voter turnout.
Americans need to get out and vote.
That's the message from hundreds of CEOs across the country who have pledged to support their employees' constitutional right to cast a ballot. Workers shouldn't have to choose between earning a paycheck and voting, says J.J. Huggins, a spokesman for Patagonia, a global outdoor clothing and equipment company with about 2,000 employees in the United States. Patagonia's CEO gave all its employees a paid day off on Election Day in 2016.
By doing that, she was telling the Patagonia workforce that on Election Day, nothing is more important than getting out there and casting your ballot.
Patagonia, which describes itself as an activist company, is co-founder of Time to Vote, a nonpartisan movement led by nearly 600 businesses with the goal of increasing voter participation in the U.S.
I mentioned Walmart. We also have Target, Best Buy, Visa, Deloitte, JP Morgan Chase, Twitter, Uber, Lyft. You think of these companies and how many people they employ and the range of from blue collar to white collar, we're going to have a far larger impact.
Such company involvement is crucial, given that 35% of voters have cited scheduling conflicts with work as a primary factor that keeps them from the polls. U.S. elections are traditionally held on a Tuesday, a normal workday.
There's a real role that companies can play in this moment to give their workers the space and opportunity to vote, as well as to leverage their brands and platforms to create a culture of civic participation.
Vote.org works with companies like Patagonia to implement vote-friendly policies and practices.
That's a combination of removing work-related barriers, but also proactively providing voting information and resources to their employees.
In June, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg said his company will be helping 4 million people register to vote.
And that includes information on voter registration, voting by mail, and early voting.
And Uber recently announced that in addition to giving its salaried employees the day off on Election Day, it's providing resources on the Uber and Uber Eats platforms to help people register to vote and get to the polls, and plans to feed people in line. The sheer number of companies that are encouraging and enabling Americans to vote is unprecedented, says Gilbert, and she'd like to see more.
We'd love to see the 100 million people that sat out in the last election show up to vote this year, and figuring out ways that we can systematically tackle and dismantle and remove any of those barriers is critical work that we want to see done in the next 100 days.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
There's more VOA Asia Weekend coming up.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, there has been much controversy in the United States over the removing of Confederate and other monuments that celebrate figures with a racist past. Russia offers a cautionary warning about the perils of dismantling history too fast. Charles Maines has more for us from Moscow.
In August 1991, thousands of people gathered outside the Russian White House in central Moscow. Communist hardliners had just launched a coup, a last-ditch attempt to stop democratic reforms embodied by Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev's perestroika. The public rallied behind Boris Yeltsin, both an ally and rival of Gorbachev's, who led a successful revolt against the coup plotters and ultimately the USSR. But for many, the symbolic end of the Soviet Union came on a square outside the KGB headquarters in Moscow. The removal of Iron Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the Soviet secret police, signaled a stark break with the violence and repression of the past. Only this wasn't just the will of the crowd. Amid concerns someone might get hurt trying to topple the statue, Moscow's first freely elected government arranged for Dzerzhinsky's removal following a late-night vote.
No, he wasn't torn down. We raised him off his pedestal using two cranes because he was so heavy you needed to, and we lowered him down on a platform.
Felix ultimately ended up here, a park in central Moscow that's become an outdoor museum to discarded Soviet relics. A place to reflect on the darker chapters of Soviet life and perhaps how much the new Russia has changed.
Monuments are something by nature always in the wrong place, because at some point they're put up and they stand there. But time keeps moving forward.
Today, Bolshevik leader Vladimir Lenin still dots the landscape, ignored by most. But polls show growing admiration for Soviet leader Joseph Stalin, and Russia's security services are again a powerful force in Vladimir Putin's Russia. Throughout, Dzerzhinsky has remained in the park. A fact that those who helped bring him here say is due to having preserved the monument while putting his legacy in context.
You can't allow these monuments to be desecrated because it provokes a desire for revenge, to return them back. That's the price of desecration, and thankfully we avoided it.
It's a message something may prove helpful to Western societies as they grapple with monuments to their own complex histories, deciding who deserves a pedestal and who should be put away forever. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
With concerts, festivals, tours, and award shows all around the world canceled or put on indefinite hold, many professional musicians and composers who had relied on performances for their income have found themselves in a difficult situation. But some say that these challenges present the opportunities to grow. We hear more from Maria Pruse.
A fiery mix of bluegrass, Irish folk and rock music brought by a DC based band Scythian has been entertaining a Facebook crowd live twice a month. What started as a smartphone webcast in March evolved into a full-scale, multi-camera, professional-sounding performance called Warren Stream.
Every stream will have between 15 and 20 festivals and music venues partnering and cross-posting with us. And so we've been averaging about 50,000 views per stream. I mean, we don't get paid for those views, but we ask people for Venmo tips or like PayPal, and the people have been incredibly generous. So that's how we've been surviving till now.
Not only did Scythian largely depend on the festivals, they were planning their 6th annual Bluegrass Festival in Virginia Mountains that attracted over 8,000 people last year.
Entertainment has always been recession-proof. So our band has survived two recessions. When people are doing poorly in recessions, they want to go out and forget. And we're excited about this year, and then all of a sudden, yeah, it's probably not going to happen. But I think if we can keep on growing our fan base with the Corner Streams, then when we go back to doing the festival, more people are going to know about us than ever before.
Andrew Krause, a Maryland-based concert pianist, has also started his Facebook classical music series called Respite. He says he has always advised his students to look for sources of additional income, but it's up to the audience whether or not to support his work online.
If you want artists to be able to produce content, you have to support us. Because if we are working 18 hours a day at something else, then we don't have the energy, time, and ultimately the expertise to produce anything for you that you're really going to want to listen to. It will truly become the age of the amateur.
Meanwhile, Krause advises musicians to keep their hopes up and teach online.
A little bit different, but you can learn to use that technology and make it work for you. And this is a great time for it. I mean, it's summer. The kids are out of school. They can't go anywhere much. So this would be the time to go and advertise.
Teaching is something New York City-based opera singer Antonina Chekhovska is focusing on now.
Really build a studio and sort of start my own brand, because I'm also at a place where I know what I'm doing. Like I'm not world famous, I know what I'm doing, I'm singing.
Musicians agree that if the industry survives, it's going to come out of the pandemic looking very different. And musicians will no doubt be able to develop a whole new creative approach. Maria Pruse in Washington, VOA News.
Among growing tensions between the United States and China is the South China Sea. China claims much of the busy maritime waters rich in minerals and food above the so-called Nine Dash Line on the map. But nearly a dozen other nations also have overlapping claims off their shores. China has increasingly been patrolling and taking actions in the South China Sea, while the United States, which has no claim, is committed to keeping international waters open for free movement. As both nations' navies have increased activity there, VOA's Adriana Zhang spoke with Bonnie Glazer, Senior Advisor for Asia and the Director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, for the latest in the South China Sea.
The United States has said in the past that China's nine-dash line was illegal, but it did not legally interpret the ruling very narrowly, specifically concerning the legality or illegality of China's coercive activities inside exclusive economic zones of other countries that extend from their coastline. So this pertains to the rights of countries to fish, to exploit oil and gas inside their waters. And the United States has really not had the legal basis to stand up for those rights. And so it is now aligning its policy more closely with that 2016 ruling.
Is it more a symbolic thing, or actually it means that the U.S. is going to take any concrete action, like military action, towards China?
Well, I think it certainly means that we will see tougher statements against China and in support of the rightful actions by countries like Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines, to access their resources that are in their waters. There could be the deployment of military ships involved against China. We actually saw this previewed in May when there were some Chinese law enforcement vessels, a survey ship, and maritime militia vessels that were operating around an oil rig called the West Capella in Malaysia's waters. And the United States actually did dispatch a Navy vessel to the region, probably not very close to the activity that China was engaged in. But I do think that this suggests that there is more willingness on the part of the United States to use both rhetoric and military vessels in order to push back against Chinese coercion and intimidation in the region.
What does that mean to the countries in that region?
Well, I think the U.S. hope is that countries will feel more emboldened to exercise their rights, that they will not be intimidated by China. They will not shut down oil and gas operations, for example, or they will not feel that they have to accommodate to Chinese interests. They will know that they have some greater support from the United States. We do not know exactly what that will mean in all possible circumstances, but the United States is signaling that it doesn't only care about freedom of navigation by military vessels in the South China Sea. It cares about the larger freedoms that all nations have and are protected under the Convention on the Law of the Seas. And this is particularly important when it comes to fish and when it comes to oil and gas.
Bonnie Glazer, Senior Advisor for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, speaking with VOA's Adriana Zhang. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. The United States has passed the marker of 150,000 deaths from COVID-19, as some spots around the country continue to see rising case numbers. The political, economic, and public health crises are a source of ongoing concern for lawmakers. But the nation's top health experts did have some encouraging news late last week, telling a congressional panel that development of a vaccine for the virus is proceeding rapidly. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson tells us more.
For the first time since June, new cases of COVID-19 fell nationwide compared to the previous week. But with the number of cases still rising in some states, U.S. lawmakers Friday sought answers from the experts leading the Trump administration response.
Can you help us understand why? While Europe has largely contained the virus, the United States is seeing a continued rise in new cases.
If you look at what happened in Europe when they shut down or locked down or went to shelter in place, however you want to describe it, they really did it to the tune of about 95%+ of the country did that. When you actually look at what we did, even though we shut down, even though it created a great deal of difficulty, we really functionally shut down only about 50%.
The United States has ramped up testing in the last few weeks, but with the debate over reopening the American economy still a politically sensitive issue, experts warn testing is no substitute for preventative measures.
We cannot test our way out of this or any other pandemic. Testing does not replace personal responsibility. It does not substitute for avoiding crowded indoor spaces or washing hands or wearing a mask.
Precautions that many hope will bridge the gap until early next year, when officials estimate a vaccine could be ready.
Ultimately, within a reasonable period of time, the plans now allow for any American who needs a vaccine to get it within the year 2021.
Right, and that is the plan.
The White House said that speed is due to the president's leadership.
These critical investments in a coronavirus vaccine are due to the fact that we have a businessman in the White House.
But congressional Democrats accuse the president and Republicans of failing to deliver needed aid to Americans who are out of work and struggling. Katherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue now with VOA Asia Weekend. U.S. President Donald Trump suggested voting by mail could make the November 3rd presidential election results fraudulent, asking on social media whether the vote should be delayed. Trump's tweet sparked a debate on election security on Capitol Hill, where Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is testifying. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more from Washington.
For the first time, U.S. President Donald Trump is suggesting delaying this year's presidential election, grabbing the world's attention with a tweet. In it, he alleges, without evidence, that mail-in balloting may make this the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. Trump asks, delay the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote? The president does not have the power to delay the election, which is to be held November 3rd. The date is set by Congress under the U.S. Constitution.
Committee will come to order. Good morning, everyone.
The tweet came as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was testifying at a Senate hearing on proposed cuts to the State Department budget. Several Democratic senators said they were stunned by the president's tweet and asked Pompeo if a president can delay a presidential election.
You are one of the most highly trained and accomplished lawyers who are part of this administration. Can a president delay a presidential election?
Senator, the Department of Justice, others will make that legal determination. We all should want, I know you do too, Senator Kaine, want to make sure we have an election that everyone is confident in.
Both the National Association of State Election Directors and the National Association of Secretaries of State told VOA Thursday they are unaware of any developments that could have an impact on the security of this year's election. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The U.S. gross domestic product contracted 9.5% in the second quarter. That's the worst drop ever recorded, according to data published by the Department of Commerce. The massive fall in economic output comes as the country experiences a surge in coronavirus cases that has forced many states to tap their brakes on reopening plans in an effort to again slow the spread of the disease. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports.
The gross domestic product contracted in the April-June quarter as the coronavirus outbreak forced struggling businesses to close for a second time in many parts of the country. The GDP is the key measure of goods and services produced.
We did see economic output fall by 9.5% in simple terms. That's 32.9% in annualized terms in the second quarter, and that added to about a 10.5% contraction in the first half of the year.
Some interpreted the nearly 33% annualized rate as the U.S. economy shrinking by a third. But Gregory Dacko, the chief U.S. economist at Oxford Economics, says that's not the case.
The problem is that when you're in a recession, you get these steep drops in activity, and then you multiply them by four. But the assumption that you're going to carry these losses again and again over quarter and quarter does not really make much sense. So it's much more useful to talk about simple rate changes in the context of the global coronavirus recession and understand that the U.S. economy as of the second quarter was about 10% smaller than it was pre-COVID.
Earlier this week, Jerome Powell, chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve, warned that early signs of a bounce back are now at risk as some parts of the U.S. experience a surge in coronavirus cases.
We have seen some signs in recent weeks that the increase in virus cases and the renewed measures to control it are starting to weigh on economic activity.
So far, more than 150,000 Americans have died and nearly 4.5 million more have been infected with the coronavirus.
The path forward for the economy is extraordinarily uncertain and will depend in large part on our success in keeping the virus in check.
Dacko echoed the concern.
There are risks that with a renewed spread of the virus and with the lack of passage of urgent fiscal aid, people might start pulling back on spending once again, and that could lead to a double dip type of recession.
He says that's not the case right now, but the situation needs to be monitored very carefully. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Coronavirus questions. Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you are sick or advised to by local authorities.
We're back with more VOA Asia Weekend. The U.S. Congress is trying to agree on funding to prevent those who've lost jobs because of COVID-19 from also losing their homes. Government aid has helped many renters in the state of Virginia, but some there face eviction as both state and federal moratoriums expired. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias has the story of one family at the brink of homelessness in Alexandria, Virginia.
Originally from Sudan, U.S. citizen Sammy Burma used to earn $6,000 a month working three jobs back to back. Now, he has no job because of COVID-19.
I'm behind on my rent for 4 months. You know, all what we have right now is the unemployment money. Trying is like to have some, a little bit in the side for any emergency with the kids.
I'm afraid to lose my house. The rent is very high. We have a new baby on the way and the children to maintain.
Although Sammy has been helped by a weekly unemployment check for $758, it's not enough to pay the rent at his apartment complex. Southern Towers did not qualify under the now-expired national eviction moratorium.
The protections that prevent evictions and late fees and other fees associated with late payment are not covered under the CARES Act.
Bail Partners, the company that manages the property, says it's helping renters by waiving late fees and extending due dates. Still, after the Virginia moratorium expired in June, it filed a claim to evict Sam's family. In court, he showed proof he had been laid off. That bought him some time.
There is a protection that was put in place recently in Virginia. So if you have fallen behind and lost income due to COVID, so you were up to date on your rent before COVID hit, you can ask the court or request the court for a 60 extra days.
Under pressure, local authorities are rushing to help households like Sammy's.
It is much less expensive and less tragic for a family to remain in their home and not be evicted than it is for us to relocate them.
Cancel rent!
The national eviction threat is dire. An estimated 28 million renters and 16 million homeowners are at risk, says the real estate investment firm Amherst Capital. In Virginia, more than 1 million households face housing insecurity, says Democratic Senator Mark Warner, noting that renters are more likely to work in hard-hit industries like retail shops and hospitality. Help for renters in Sammy's building, where many tenants are African immigrants, comes from African Communities Together, among other groups.
People should not be paying rent when they're not working. We want some kind of housing justice where, you know, rent has to be commensurate with people's income.
Besides his unpaid rent, Sammy has piled up credit card debt. Driving his Uber could help, but he fears bringing the coronavirus into his one-bedroom apartment. Veronica Valeras Iglesias for VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
The Voice of America has been broadcasting for almost 80 years to millions of people worldwide. And much of the legacy of that success is owed to Willis Conover, who helped popularize jazz throughout Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. For 41 years, he hosted the Jazz Hour on The Voice of America, introducing a worldwide audience to a most unique form of American music.
Dark days behind the Iron Curtain, after the Soviet Union extended its grip as far as East Germany. From Washington, the sounds of another world over the radio.
This is The Voice of America Jazz Hour.
Thelonious Monk and Dizzy Gillespie were among the many jazz greats who appeared on Conover's program, drawing millions of listeners over 41 years.
They came to VOA for the jazz and they stayed for the news.
News they couldn't get in their own countries.
The music of jazz parallels the freedom that we have in America. Something that not every country has.
Jazz as an art form was not just a wonderful thing to listen to, but it was something people could learn from without necessarily realizing they were learning from it.
Conover provided encouragement to Eastern Bloc jazz lovers, and in 1956, during the Hungarian uprising against Soviet domination.
The 1956 program featuring the Hungarian musicians who had secretly sent a tape to Willis Conover.
Here for the world is their living testimonial in the universal language of music.
Conover accompanied State Department jazz tours through Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and Africa.
Van Willis Conover.
A VOA technician who later worked with Conover on his shows spent many hours listening to his stories.
He was so deep into the jazz world, the musicians knew him, they trusted him, which was very important because when he started working at VOA, some musicians would say that he sold out when he did not at all sell out. In fact, what he did was he opened up the rest of the world, mainly the Eastern Bloc countries, to this music.
This is the Voice of America. Washington, D.C.
Conover died in 1996, but left a legacy. He introduced the world to the creative energies of jazz and to the country that gave birth to the music. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of some of the stories presented throughout the past week on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check out VOA Asia online at voanews.com.